All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Jake Dunlap Show. We are very excited that you joined us. If you haven't tuned in, this is the show where we talk to celebrities, thought, and industry leaders to really discover their journey to success. I am super excited that you're joining us. This show is like no other. I can promise you that. You might laugh, you might cry, but you will definitely leave inspired and gain a whole new level of insight into those people that you follow, love, and admire. All right, welcome everyone to another episode of the Jake Dunlap Show. I am really, really excited about this conversation. I had a chance to catch up with this gentleman a few weeks ago, and I know it's going to be a great conversation for everyone here. So today's guest, and we'll see if you can guess it, is a pillar in the global branding and communications world with over 30 years of experience. This guy has worked with Coca-Cola, Lenovo, Nissan, Verizon. I know I'm not doing you justice, by the way, because there's a lot more. His talents are known throughout the world. This guy's literally lived and worked everywhere. So not only has he done this in, you know, America or North America, he's done this in Asia, Europe, Africa, throughout his career. He's led advertising agencies. He's managed some of the biggest global accounts in the world and headed multinational strategy teams. And I'm really excited to talk about, he also did his own thing for a little bit as well. So his businesses continue to stay at the forefront of what it means to be a truly innovative brand. And so this week, I want you to please join me in welcoming branding legend and Leeds United fan, Daniel Binns. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Jake, it's great to be here. And I think it should be the way around, Leeds United fan and branding legend.
Hey, I get that. I'm the American Kansas City Chiefs fan. And so I kind of put that as the first and sales, you know, business leader. So that's great. And you actually have the street cred, at least. At least you were born there, right? In America, the amount of Man United fans or, you know, Arsenal fans, right? They don't have the same street cred as you.
Yeah, no, exactly. You can't adopt your football team. You need to, you know, it needs to be in your blood. I
agree, right? I agree. That's why I left Kansas City, I don't know, many, many years ago now, and I will never have another football team. Like, it's not possible. So let's dive in. So we talked about this before. Really, you know, the point of the show is really talking about the stories that led to where you are today as, you know, CEO of Interbrand. So let's go back to Leeds. So you're born in Leeds. What was early childhood Daniel like? What were you into? What were some kind of big memories you had early on growing up in Leeds before high school?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the sort of halcyon days of the 1970s. You know, I have very fond memories of my early childhood. So much freedom. I was the youngest of three kids. I think my parents had sort of like given up with child raising by the time I came along. So I had the run of things. I would just go off and do stuff. My older brother was always slightly horrified by the stuff that I got up to. I remember once being on a camping trip with my parents, and my brother was there, and he said, where's Daniel? And my dad said, I think he's gone fishing. I was probably, I don't know, six or something. And he looked over the wall from the campsite, and there was this raging river that was running down the back. And he said, what? He's down there. I said, yeah, he's down there fishing or something. And I'd taken myself off with my fishing rod. And my brother was really worried. He came looking for me. And sure enough, I was like sort of, you know, stuck to a fish hook. And it's like, you should be here on your own. And I was totally fine with it. My parents were totally fine with it. So I did have a lot of freedom. And I really embraced that. I mean, I think that's a little bit of probably who I am today is driven by that, you know, the sort of how much I was empowered to just do what I wanted to do as a kid. So, which is nice.
I love that. Yeah. And I think, you know, as we kind of get into it, there's just a lot of these early memories, and it's interesting still, I mean, today, just how vivid that is for you, right? Of this fishing, like, do you remember the river is raging though? Or to you?
Not really. I definitely was pretty fearless. So, I mean, I didn't think about it at the time. Now I look back and I can almost see it through my eyes. I'm like, what the hell was I thinking? Or what were they thinking?
That's right.
Didn't bother me at all.
So, all right. So your adventure, you have this freedom. What were your parents into? What were your parents into? And, you know, was that influential on you at all, you know, in your early childhood?
Yeah, for sure. My dad worked a lot. He worked at Leeds University pretty much his entire career. So he wasn't an academic. He was the, you know, assistant bursar. So he was sort of an administrator. You know, Leeds is one of the biggest universities in the country. You know, I can't remember how many, 10,000 at least students. So he worked a lot. My mom, unfortunately, had depression from the time my brother was born. She was sort of not really diagnosed with it as postpartum depression. You know, my brother is 63 now, and pretty much throughout her entire life and my growing up, she was severely depressed. So I have, which is, it's a sad reality. I mean, it's obviously a thing that afflicts many people, but certainly in the '70s, you know, terribly badly diagnosed. She had electric shock treatment and, you know, really just not well handled. My dad therefore became the counterbalance to mum's sort of negativity and depression, which is like, he is the most positive human being you will ever meet. So whatever you say to dad, he will always say, "Oh, it could be much worse. It's only a broken leg, but you've got another one." So he's just very positive. And I've definitely got that optimism and positivity from him, which was just a little bit of a counter to being able to deal with mum, who was, you know, just very negative, as you can imagine.
Yeah, struggling with her own things.
Exactly. So she was not around that much. And I think that's partly why I was, you know, left to my own devices, because, you know, and my brother and sister were, you know, my sister is 5 years older than me and brother's 9. So by the time, you know, and they both left house at 18, my sister to become a nurse and go to work and my brother to go to college. And so I was left alone, you know, pretty much as an only child in that sense, growing up in that environment. So again, it gave me a bit of freedom, which was good. And, you know, it was tough at times because, you know, with mum's depression, sort of being around that, I sort of pushed myself out of the house quite a lot in order to be able to just do my own thing and sort of escape that a little bit.
What were you getting into then? What were your passions then?
It was always with friends. I was just with a group of people. You know, we were roaming. I mean, roaming the streets.
Were you in the city? You were in the city.
To begin with, in Leeds I was. I'm in the suburbs. But, you know, we were just out and about, playing in the fields, getting up to stuff. You know, we had, again, so much freedom compared to what kids have today. I mean, I remember I went to school age like 9, 10. I had to like an hour's commute on a series of public buses to get to school. You know, 2 or 3 buses I had to change to get there. And it was totally fine. I did a paper round, you know, delivering papers when I was probably like 7 or 8, you know, going out, crossing main roads, a huge sack of newspapers, you know, which I really loved. I remember getting, you know, my first wages, whichever it was, like 50 pence, like, you know, whatever, for a week, whatever that would have been, 75 cents or something. I was definitely adventurous. But then I moved to the countryside when I was probably about 12, 13. I left the city, I left Leeds, moved out to beautiful part of the world, the Yorkshire Dales, very pretty countryside. And then I really got into farming. That became my big passion. So I met a guy who weirdly was one of my teachers at school. And my first day at school in his class, he said, "What's your name, boy?" I said, "Daniel Binns, sir." And he said, "That's weird. My father-in-law was called Daniel Binns." Absolutely rude. And we're not related, but I was actually sort of named after his father-in-law, who was a pretty famous painter in Yorkshire. And so I got to know him pretty well. He had a farm close to where we lived. I asked him if I could come and work on the farm at the weekends, and he said, "Yeah, sure." So I ended up doing that pretty much every weekend, every vacation from school, from age 13 to 18.
That
was,
wow,
my life was working on the farm. And
wow. What out of all, you know, again, you're kind of doing these things with all your friends, what was it that drew you to that in particular, you know, that type of life?
I think it was just, you know, I was just awe inspired by these people. I mean, it was a fascinating, I mean, this is sort of 1980s, I guess. So, but it was a last era of farming, which sort of generational farming. So the guy, his name was Stanley Walker, who owned the farm. Walker's farm had owned it for something like 6 generations, and his father had the farm before him, and he was still around, and his uncles, you know, in their 70s, I guess they would have been, were still around, and they used to wear tweed suits shirts and ties on the farm. You know, these incredible old characters. And I was so in awe of them. And the guy was a guy that managed the farm, a guy called John Harrison. He was like the sort of farm, not laborer, but he was, because Stanley, the guy that owned the farm, was also a teacher. And so this guy actually ran the farm.
Yeah.
And he was just amazing. Like, he could do anything, fix anything. He was totally fearless. He would drive tractors up crazy cliffs and who knows what. Like, he was just, I was just totally in awe of them. And you know, being physical and out in nature, and again, having a lot of freedom, being able to do milking cows and painting roofs and driving tractors. And it was just sort of boyhood dream stuff, especially having come from a big city.
Right.
And this was just like, wow, what an experience.
Yeah. I lived on a farm until I was six. And so I had a little bit of that growing up, but it does shape you, you know, it does give you just a different perspective of, you know, you're with your family, you know, there's not a million people around. I think it creates these really interesting bonds that you don't get sometimes when you live in a city.
And I think you know, for me, the other piece of the attraction was the family, the Walker family. You know, I ended up almost like living there. You know, I was there from 7 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night, and, you know, breakfast and lunch and often dinner with them. And they, you know, at a time when my mom was not well, you know, it was sort of an escape into what felt like a sort of normal family home. So I was definitely attracted to that as well. And they really looked after me. You know, they were just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful family. And still, I still see them to this day. Well, the farmer and his wife unfortunately passed away. But my son, his name is Walker, is named after Stanley Walker, who was a very influential man in my life. He was just an incredible, incredible guy.
It sounds like it. And so what type of student were you in high school? So you're working every weekend. So, you know, there's some discipline there. But what type of student were you?
Not a great one. I mean, I was a classic boy, I guess, in many ways, that just tried to do the bare minimum. I mean, I just didn't really get into it. I wasn't really passionate academically. I tried to skate through it, often not succeeding to skate through it. So, you know, I really loved being at school. I enjoyed school. I loved the camaraderie and being with my friends, and I enjoyed some of the work, but I didn't do particularly well, to be honest with you. And I think it set me on a trajectory, and it's a little different in the UK than it is in the US, where you very quickly, through your school and high school years, you narrow down into a series of subjects that you sort of end up sticking with. So I ended up getting into computer science. That was like the one thing that I quite enjoyed, and it sort of put me on this track to do that through high school and through into college. But it wasn't necessarily anything I particularly wanted to do. It was just what I happened to be reasonably good at. But yeah, so academically, I was not a superstar.
And what computer are you working on at this point? Because this is early 80s, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is hilarious. I mean, this was back in the days of punch card.
Yeah, that's what I was
wondering. Remember the guy in the
punch card?
It was punch card. Like, I remember BASIC and COBOL and Fortran and all these things. And but then in high school, I remember it was punch card. And the guy that ran the computer lab was always like covered in bits, those little bits of dots of punch card stuff. It was on his hair and on his suit. And so that was all he did all day, was punch the programming cards. So yeah, it was a different era.
everyone can Google it. For most OG programmers I know, they're like, if you don't know how to code in BASIC, like, you know, like you don't really know what it's like.
So, I should have stuck with it. I probably would have been a billionaire if I'd have been.
Well, there's some great stories about Bill Gates and how he would sneak into the, I think it was Berkeley, and with the punch cards, and like do his own computers programming on his own. And so there's some pretty cool stories.
Yeah.
So then you go to uni, you go to University of Greenwich, so you get out, but you leave the computer science. So after 1 year and some failed math exams, you said, yeah, I don't think this was it for me. So how did you kind of make the decision to, you know, kind of start down a different path?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, this is part of that sort of conveyor belt taking me into into a subject which I was sort of good at, but not really very passionate about. So I ended up, yeah, it was actually called Thames Polytechnic back then. It's now called the University of Greenwich, which sounds much grander. But yeah, I remember uttering the now famous words to my friends, oh, don't worry, they won't throw you out for failing maths. And sure enough, they did throw me out for failing maths. So I after a year, one of my lecturers at the time said, you know, I don't think this is for you. You know, you're a great people person. You're a salesperson. You need to be doing something that's more human interaction, you know, rather than just sitting in a dark room coding, which is what, you know, other people were doing. And so that was a big turning point, obviously, for me. And I remember telling my dad at the time, who, as I say, was a lifelong university guy and a big believer in higher education and academics. And he was always, he was always extremely supportive for me. And he said, I called him up and said, by the way, Dad, I've dropped out of college. And he said, what? I said, decided I didn't really like it. And it was the only time I think he ever swore at me. And he said, I don't care that you don't like it. That's not the point. And I remember that conversation has stuck in my head and was very formative, because I was like, from that moment, I was like, I'm going to show you. I don't need to go to university. I am going to be way more successful than you've ever dreamt of. And it really drove me. That one chat, like, you know, because he felt that this was the worst thing I could possibly do, and I felt guilty. I'm going to show you that it's okay. Like, I'm going to make a success out of this. I don't need a university degree to be successful.
Yeah, it's always interesting how, like, these conversations stick with us. And I'm sure, I mean, have there been points over the last, you know, 20, 30 years where you've referenced that? I'm sure there's been many where you're thinking back to it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's a recurring theme.
I love it. Yeah, I talked to a gentleman, Dan Harris, who wrote a book, 10% Happier. He's an anchor in Good Morning America. And he had an instance where his parents had taken him to a hotel in Paris called the Hotel Regina. And, you know, this idea just kind of stuck with him, you know, for forever. And I think there's so many of those conversations that when we take the time to really think about it, that, you know, really help to shape us and provide some type of, like, whether it's a chip on our shoulder or, you know, just some little internal motivation to keep you going. So what's the first? So, obviously, you got into McCann pretty early, but what did you do in between? So you decide, you know, uni isn't for me.
Yeah.
Or actually, the uni decided it wasn't for you first.
Correct. they I like to start. I tell you the way now. Well, I decided. I dropped out of like jobs of Bill Gates and rather than I got thrown out.
So what did you do between that and then you get into McCann, you know, and get into the ad world? Or was it kind of straight into that world?
Well, no. So I was 19, and my sister-in-law at the time worked in advertising. So I had no idea what I wanted to do. I knew I just didn't want to do computer science. And she said, you know, you should do advertising. You'd be really great at that. And so I started looking into it and thought, oh, that sounds great. And I applied for jobs as an account executive, which, you know, at the time was sort of the sexy end of what I saw as being working in advertising. And as a 19-year-old, no degree, you know, like, I didn't really get much of a look in. And I had a couple of interviews, and somebody said, you know, you should probably, if you want to get in, why don't you get in, you know, if you want to get into advertising, go through media.
Right.
Work for a media company. So I ended up working for a TV station in the UK selling TV airtime. I tried to call every sales director, like the head of the company, from the largest one, because there were 13 stations in the UK at that time, from the largest one to the smallest one. And the second to last one was the only one that took my call. And that was what I ended up working for. Border TV, it was called. And then, but very, very quick, then I was dealing with ad agencies, and I got a job offer then from an agency called BMP, which is now part of DDB. It was an amazing agency back in the day. Bose, Massimi, and Pollitt. So I ended up as a media buyer at BMP. That was my first agency job. And then I, after two or three years, I guess, of being there, I decided, I saw this opportunity to join what was called the International Media Department of McKenna Erickson. And I looked and I thought, wow, that sounds so sexy. I want to be in the International Media Department. And I went for an interview and I didn't get the job. I got on very well with the guy who was the head, but he said, you know, I really need somebody who's actually got experience. He'd come from the UK media business, and this was really about, it was actually pan-European. It's like all working with the European network of McCann. It was about pan-European TV and, you know, Time, Newsweek, you know, dealing with a sort of international press. He said, I need somebody who's got experience in this because I don't. Yeah. I'm going to hire somebody. And I was really devastated. I really want that job. And then there was a launch, big launch of a new media company in the UK. And I thought, I know this guy is going to be there. And so I went to that conference, made a point of going, and I hung around to try and find him. And at the very end, I spotted him as he was leaving. And I went up to him and said, hey, Nick, how are you? Good to see you again. Remember me? I came to interview you. And we started chatting again. And at the end of it, he said, you know, I haven't filled that role. Maybe you should come back for another interview. And I went back to the interview and I got the job. So that was the turning point really in my career, was getting that role. And so it's a bit like, you know, make your own luck. I mean, I was sort of, it was luck that I bumped into him, but I was trying to make sure
I bumped into him. But you didn't give up, right? You showed up. I was talking to had a little mini debate where we debated how much of luck or these instances are just showing up and giving yourself the at bat. And, you know, some people, well, it matters, but it's, you know, so many people, I think, give up too early, or at least don't exhaust all options and accept it. And there's so many stories, you know, through the podcast and through others of that, just that extra one thing, because we never know, you never know when it's going to be that time, you know, because there could be another time where you go and you didn't get it. But because you have that gear, you will show up, you know, when the opportunity does.
Sure.
But this is interesting. So is the very first assignment, I mean, I know that you worked, obviously, I think you started in kind of London, Brussels, and then pretty quickly, I mean, you're in, it was one of the first assignments in Bahrain?
Yeah. Well, it was actually called the European Media Department is what it was eventually called. But so I had a boss who was a European Media Manager. He reported to the European Media Director of McCann Erickson. And they both left. So they both left, and it was only a tiny team. It was me and one other woman at that point. And they said, well, listen, the guy who's going to run this now is currently the CEO of McCann in Brussels. So we're going to move the department to Brussels. And you're the only guy that seems to know, you know, what's going on, because nobody else is, you know, I was 24 or 5 or something. You know, nobody else knows anything about this. So will you go to Brussels? And I was like, yeah, sure, I go to Brussels. So I went to Brussels and then worked with them for a while, and then became a much bigger team. And we get that point in the media business, European management of media agencies became much more significant, so it grew the business. And then after a couple of years, they moved it back. They said, we're actually going to move it back to London, because the guy who was sort of shepherding it, you know, they realized that you needed to be in London. It was the center of the European advertising business. I said, I don't really want to go back to London. I quite like this whole expatriate thing. Yeah. So I said, is there something else? Is there another job? And they said, well, was this job in Bahrain? And I said, fine, I'll go to Bahrain then. So I was regional media director in Bahrain, which was, you know, there were 13 offices in the network in the Middle East, from, you know, Beirut to Tunis and, you know, Morocco, Egypt, all through the Gulf, and so I went to Bahrain, and this was definitely, I think this was a part of, I think how I moved, and B, how I became successful. I always said yes. I was open to anything, and I didn't plan. I had friends that would have their 5-year plan for their career.
Right.
I was like, why do you do that? Like, you just got to take the opportunities that come along. You don't have like a 5-year plan. It's just too.
Yeah, it always works out that way. Yeah, you're like, oh yeah, 5 years is exactly the thing. And to your point, you just miss out on that serendipity.
Yeah.
So you go to Bahrain, and let me ask you this: before the move to Brussels, just kind of how you described it, had you traveled a lot as a child? I mean, had you traveled a lot as a family prior to some of these moves?
Not really, no. I mean, I think by the time I mean, I'd probably been to France and Spain on vacation. I think that was the only places I'd been outside of the UK. And even when I was in London, I remember my first business trip was to Paris. And I remember, you know, going business class on British Airways, and I was, you know, whatever it was, 24, 25. And I remember at one point going for the day, like I flew in the morning, I had a meeting, I had a lunch with somebody, and I came back. And I remember telling my grandmother, who was at that time probably in her late 80s, and I said, you know, she said, "What have you done today, dear?" I said, "Well, I actually went to Paris for lunch and came back." And she was, so, I mean, she wasn't even fazed. It was so, I may as well have said, "I've gone to Mars and back." She had no comprehension that anybody could possibly have flown to Paris and back in a day. It's like, she's like,
right.
She had no idea. Straight over her head. But so, yeah, I really started traveling with that job. I had not traveled really at all until that point.
Yeah, and then you move up, I mean, to a president, right? So first to Jakarta and then to Malaysia. So, again, you're just saying yes to these, you know, you're moving further and further east, basically. Well, maybe east, then kind of a little bit back west. You know, what was it for you that, again, like those opportunities? Because, again, I think a lot of people would be hesitant, you know, even though it is, you know, title-wise a step up. What kind of kept you going or let you know, like you said, you always kind of just said yes. You know, was there anything kind of directionally, and again, not having a five-year plan, but just the opportunities that seemed to just be the right fit for you at the time?
Yeah, I think I was never afraid to take a role that seemed outside of my abilities. You know, from that original, every one of the jobs I ever had, I didn't really have the qualifications to do it. And and there's a lot talked about the difference between men and women and this, and, you know, there's sort of stats about men, you know, women feel like they have to have 100% of the capabilities to take on a role, and men have 60, you know, and it's a terrible, some sad reality of the differences in the genders, but you know, it served me well. I mean, in the sense that I just pushed myself to do things that were very much outside my comfort zone. So, you know, I'd been in the media business. I was in Bahrain in this regional media role, which was certainly a much bigger job than I was probably capable of doing. And then I happened to be very lucky when that job, 3.5 years sort of in, I said, this has sort of come to an end. What's next? And somebody said, there's a job in Jakarta in Indonesia. I thought, oh, I don't really want to do a media job in Indonesia. It didn't sound that exciting. But I'll go and meet the guy. And the guy, it was a guy called Marcio Moreira, he was the vice chairman of McCann, very, very influential guy. And at the time, he was the head of Asia Pacific. So I met him in Singapore. I flew to Singapore and met him. He said, so yeah, this job is actually not a media job. It's the managing director, like sort of president of the office in Indonesia, which is 120 people or something. You know, and I was 29. I'd only been in media, and you know, thank goodness he took a flyer on me and said, "I think you can do it." And I thought, "I can do it." but it was a huge step to suddenly be in charge of, you know, the creative product and client management. Also, I'd never done any of that before. I'd just been a media director, and I was 29, and this was a big office. He was hugely influential. So I think somebody asked me the other day, like, you know, I feel very fortunate to have stayed in one place. I stayed at McCann for 18 years. I moved constantly. So I never felt like it was a one place, but I grew to know people. Marcio, you know, went from being head of Asia Pacific back to New York, vice chairman, and he was my mentor. Like, he just kept his eye on me. And then he was the one that then moved me from, after 3 years in Indonesia, and moved me to Malaysia, which was a much bigger office, CEO of the office there. But it was the fact that I had those relationships, which is hard to do. And I tell people, like somebody asked me, how come, you know, somebody I mentor now, a young girl, he said, how did you become CEO of Interbrand in New York? And I said, you know, I don't think I did. How did I? But I said, you know, the thing is, I stuck with it. It's very rare that you get to be the head of a company and parachuted in from outside that company. So you have to, I know it's a temptation with young people, is that every 2 years I need to change jobs. And that's great, and your career will go up, but you may well never get to that top slot, because the top slot will be always somebody who's been in the company for 8 or 10 years. They're not going to get the CEO's position to, I mean, occasionally they do, but more often than not, they don't. So,
they're somewhere else usually, right? If that's the case, they're kind of coming in many times.
That's right. Yeah, you got to get to that level. And then maybe when you are CEO, you'll get moved to another job as a CEO or a CMO, whatever it is. But to rise to the top, you've got to eventually put your flag in one place and say, I'm going to do it here.
Well, and you know, the grass isn't always greener. I did a YouTube video on this about don't quit. You know, we're in the middle of this great resignation right now. And for a lot of people, I remember, and we'll get to kind of the last financial meltdown and how you kind of went and started doing your own thing too. The learnings that you have during the dips and you pull out of it, you find something new. It just, you can't account for that. There's no learning because, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize, like, if you feel like you're here, you're going to be starting over somewhere else.
Totally.
And like you said, all those relationships and everything start over. And I don't think, you know, you don't have to have this 5 or 10 or 15 year view on your perfect career. But it's to me, how I think about it, Daniel, is you do have to say, well, what are my skill sets? Am I continuing to grow? And 9 times out of 10, you can find some pretty amazing opportunities at the company that you're at. And I just wish more people would think that way versus I'm stuck with a boss or something like that.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, yeah, you need, I mean, I make light of the fact that I didn't have a plan. I had a goal. I wanted to grow my career. I knew I wanted to get, I was wanting to come to New York. That was like, well, my dreams is to be working in the advertising business in New York. And I was like, how am I going to get there? And so I was quite conscious of it. You know, when I left Malaysia, it was because I realized I needed to be retooled. You know, I'd been in Bahrain for 3 years. I'd been in Indonesia for 3 years. I'd been in Malaysia for 3 years. And I'd sort of learned a lot about management. I mean, a huge amount.
Oh, man.
I was very lucky. 9 years of leading, you know, large groups, large businesses. I'd learned management. But I had lost touch with the technical skills of the advertising business. So I really wanted, I thought, I'm going to become like the, you know, Asia developing market expert, and that my career will be stunted. So I really wanted to go. So I went back to London to run the Coca-Cola business for Europe, because I thought that would be a really great way to actually, you know, Coke, certainly then, if, you know, less so now, but was the leading marketer in the world. And if you're going to learn your craft, work on the Coke business, you know, they always push you, and they did. And so that was a conscious decision to make sure I had the skills reskilled for what the next part of my career would require.
Yeah. Did anyone have to tell you that? Did Massimo or did anyone say, hey, you know, if you want to do this, you should think, do you remember if it was more of an internal decision?
Or an internal thing. It was just a reflection on, okay, 9 years of this, I see people around me, you know, who were, you know, because again, I was not that old. I was, you know, 32 or something when I left Malaysia. So I was young, but I could see these guys in Malaysia in their 40s, like, they ain't going anywhere. No one's going to hire them. They're stuck working in the developing world. If I wanted to do that, fine, but I didn't. You know, my dream was going to New York and become, you know, a leader in the ad business in New York. Like, it was not going to happen if I just stayed for the rest of my career in Asia. So, you know, as much as I loved working in Asia, it was an amazing experience and some great friends from there. I learned so much about people and culture and, you know, but I just felt I needed to up my skill set.
And I think, yeah. And the reason I asked is I think the lesson there is, you know, I talk to a lot of people too, I'm sure you do, about professional, you know, career development, professional development. And I see some people that they kind of look at their company to say, well, what should I do? Or how should I grow? And what I see, the people that move up the fastest are the ones that assess the skill set gaps. They assess not even just gaps, or their strengths too, right? The other side, which is, this is where I'm strong. And I, you know, there's a point in my career was leading a team for 2.5 years. And it's like, what's next? And it's like, I think it's 29 at the time too. It's like, well, I've never done enterprise. I've never been like an enterprise. So how am I at 29 going to tell a 50-year-old, you know, person, hey, this is what you should do? And so I was like, I need to go into enterprise sales. Like, I need to leave my cush leadership and get in the trenches. And it was one of the, you know, and then a year later, you know, I was able to get my first, you know, VP of sales role at Glassdoor. And it was 100% because I just started to think about, okay, well, what's next? What are the skill sets? And I think so, not enough people take that approach versus how much money am I going to make at the next job? what's my title going to be, as opposed to like, am I setting myself up for bigger things later?
Yeah. And to your point, you know, you can find ways to do that and get those skills often within the company you're in.
Exactly.
And, you know, and enlightened companies are recognizing they have to do that. You know, you are providing people with a, you know, it's not a ladder, career ladder, it's a career lattice that you can move around from different places to get the skills that you need in order to continue to be successful.
I'm going to steal that. I've never heard that before, but I like it.
Career lattice.
I love that.
Trademarked Interbrand.
Trademarked TM. All right. So then you go down to Johannesburg. Then you get the chance to go, so you're regional vice president of Africa, and then you get a chance to go to New York. So yeah. you get a chance, you're a worldwide account director for Coca-Cola. And so does that mean you're running all of Coca-Cola's global?
Yeah. So I've had a relationship with Coke all my career. I mean, pretty much since my days in Belgium. So it was a client that I knew really well. When I went to South Africa in large part to fix an issue with the Coca-Cola business. There was by far the largest client for McCann in South Africa and across Africa. And so I ended up, you know, working in South Africa with the Coke team there. And then for whatever reason, all the guys that I knew from Coke ended up in Atlanta. A guy called Mark Mathieu, who became, you know, head of the Coke business and was then CMO of Samsung. I knew him from Singapore. He was my client when I was in Singapore. There was a couple of other guys from actually within Coke Africa who ended up in Atlanta. And so I made a pitch to John Dooner, who was the CEO of McCann at that time, because McCann had this sort of storied history with Coke. You know, they'd been the single agency for all of the Coca-Cola businesses for you know, decades, but they'd lost that relationship in the sort of late 90s. And they got to a point where there was real animosity between Coke and McCann. And they had business, they had it in Africa. We had parts of the world, certain parts of the world where we did have the business, but they'd really lost a lot of that relationship. And I said, listen, our chance to come back now, because these guys, I know all these guys, they want to do something different. They have a great, you know, I think I can get us back into the global business if you give me this role. And so he said, fine, you can have the role. Through Marcio Moreira again, it was Marcio that helped me craft the note to John Dooner at the time. And so they made me then global head of the Coke business. So, you know, we had it, I think, in 99 countries or something. It was a significant client, but we didn't have it in the US and we didn't have it in a lot of the European markets. So that was the challenge, was to get the business back. I worked with those guys for 2 or 3 years. We pitched the business globally. We didn't win it, unfortunately, but we won a few other projects, Dasani and a few other things. We got ourselves back into the game with Coke. And it was great. I mean, at that time, I was very fond of the guys who were running it. They had a real ambition to transform the Coke icon and a lot of time for what they were trying to do. And it was great fun working with them for 2 or 3 years.
And so. You get this amazing opportunity and another experience, and then you get a chance to you move back to London for Unilever to help, I believe, there too. But I want to jump to, and then you leave. So 19 years, you're like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do something on my own. So tell me about that. What was that decision like for you after being at the same place for 19 years, just having so much, you know, upward mobility and, you know, learning opportunity, coming straight out of college to all these experiences? What was it for you that you said, you know, this is in September 2007, like you picked a great time too, right? Like, it's like
there's I didn't know that at the time.
The economy. The perfect time to do it. What made you want to go out on your own? You know, and again, you did left field and then leading edge. And so maybe just talk a little bit about those years before we jump into Interbrand.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it was the last thing that I did when I was on the Coke business was I helped Coke support this nonprofit called Peace One Day. They were an amazing organization. The founder had developed the International Day of Peace, and he was really trying to find people to grow awareness of it. We got Coke to put Peace One Day on the Coke can around the world. It was an amazing achievement. They gave him, and he was like a one-man band, but they gave him £1 million. in support, and because they really believed in him. He was an amazing, amazing, tenacious human being that had a real vision for trying to create a more peaceful and sustainable world. And so partly I was like, I really want to keep doing stuff like, I'm going to do stuff like that. That's where my passion is. And I've done a lot of sort of sponsorship work and whatever, working with nonprofits in various ways. And so, you know, partly I had a chance to leave because I was running the Unilever business. They ended up moving the Unilever business from London to Milan. And I just didn't want to do it again. I was like, I'm done. So I was able to say, you know what? I'm out. Give me my money. I've been here 19 years. I'll just, you know, there's a chance to do something different. So, and I'd sort of had enough of the advertising business at that point, you know.
Yeah.
At that point, it was just, especially as a worldwide account guy, like it felt agencies were going through such turmoil in trying to continue to be relevant to clients. And I felt like clients' expectations were here. McCann's ability to deliver was down here. And I was caught in the middle, just being beaten up by clients. And I'm like, I don't need to do this anymore. So I sort of got out. And I was able to get out. And then I actually joined Peace One Day as CEO. That was the first thing I did.
And you're still involved, right? You're still involved.
I'm still involved with now. Yeah. I mean, Jeremy Gilley, who's the founder, you know, he's a great friend of mine. We Interbrand just redid their brand identity last year. You know, we still support them. They're an amazing organization. So I started doing that, and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I actually thought I wanted out of the business completely. So I thought, you know, I'm going to run a charity, run a nonprofit. That's my future. I'm not going to do anything with advertising anymore. But slowly over time, I began to reflect on the fact that actually there were certain things that I really loved about the advertising business. And it was the sort of intellectual challenge of strategy. That was what I really enjoyed. And so I continued to work for Peace One Day, but it was clear that was not going to be a full-time role. It certainly wasn't going to pay me a full-time salary. So I went back to my Coke network, and a ex-colleague at that time was the sort of global head of marketing at Kimberly-Clark. And he said, we need somebody to help on helping Kimberly-Clark create their corporate brand, like reposition their corporate brand. Why don't you come in as a consultant? I was like, great. So I set up the company, Left Field Consultancy, really to work on Kimberly-Clark. And I just ran that project and client for a couple of years and then expanded it. Expanded within Kimberly-Clark, did a bunch of things and a couple of other clients. I enjoyed working on my own. But I sort of missed the culture of a business.
Right.
It wasn't really what I wanted to do. You know, I made a lot of money and I was pretty good at it, but I just missed having a team around me. And so at the time I actually got a freelance opportunity at Interbrand, working with a guy who had previously been at McCann. I knew him from McCann days, a guy called Andy Bateman. He was the CEO of Interbrand New York. And he said, yeah, why don't you come in and work on a project for us? And I was building basically this sort of CSR and sustainability angle from the work that I'd done with Peace One Day and the work I'd done with Kimberly-Clark and a few others. And he said, we're going to build that in Interbrand. Why don't you come and build it with us? So I started doing that and built up their corporate citizenship practice, as it was called at that time. And then he left, Andy, this guy, left to go to work for this Australian company called The Leading Edge. And he was going to move to Sydney. And he said, why don't you come with me? You set up the US business, I go to Sydney. And I really loved him. He's a great guy. He now is the CEO of, what are they called? Oh, gosh, I'm blanking on the name. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So I left and went to set up that business. And that was really interesting because that was like starting a company from scratch. And it's really interesting. Like what you think you know about running a company when you run a publicly listed or a division of a publicly listed firm with whatever 120, 150 people, as I'd done previously, to then starting it from scratch, like a whole different thing. Like, what? I have no idea how to do all this. So that was an amazing learning curve. And we built that up to 12 or 13 people in New York and, you know, $3 or $4 million in revenue. It was nothing massive, but it was a lot of fun.
Sure.
But then, you know, that sort of, it was run by an Australian, it still is owned by an Australian holding company that went through a lot of financial turmoil, and all the partners of the company, TLE, sort of left. And I ended up going back to Interbrand at that point. Luckily, I was offered a role back at Interbrand.
So what made you get in? So then you get into, again, kind of back in the account director seat. So you're doing, being pretty large projects with Nissan. in particular? And is that, you know, is that kind of where you felt yourself gravitate toward, is wanting to do something like that, these kind of global brand engineers?
Yeah, I think what I really enjoyed was, I mean, I was the head of strategy, so that was a particularly interesting role. It was one of those Omnicom, you know, holding company roles where Interbrand were the lead strategy team for all of the diversified agencies that were running the Nissan business globally. TBWA was the lead agency, OMD was the media agency, the PR firms and experiential firms and digital firms and what have you. All working for Nissan globally, and then they needed somebody to lead it strategically. And I thought that was a great challenge. I'm a massive car fan, big gearhead. So this opportunity to work in the car business was definitely really attractive. And it definitely, the skills of sort of client management and strategy, you know, because it was working with, yeah, with the CMO, and to sort of manage the client side, but also then lead it strategically. Was a really interesting challenge. So I joined that group. It was being built at the time, so we were really helping to set up and establish this Nissan United, as it was called, which is a sort of consolidated agency group running the Nissan business. It was a lot of fun to do that with the two other guys, president and the head of the media business. So it was a really, really amazing experience for 2 or 3 years. And then I gravitated back into management in Interbrand New York.
And you took New York, San Francisco, Toronto. So, I mean, you're in, you know, some of these large markets. And, you know, at this point, you know, in your career, so, you know, we're getting kind of close to present day, 2016, 2018. And I know we got to wrap up here in about, you know, 10 minutes or so. But, you know, is there a point now, you know, where you have, maybe it's not a 5-year plan, but is there a point now where you kind of see, at that point in your career, of like, you know, I think I'm going to run this thing. You know, does a plan start to form at this point when you're kind of running as an MD, some of the largest offices there? Does that start to become a thought?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there had been times when I just thought I've got as far as I want to go. I'm going to plateau now, just going to take it easy. And then I reflect on that and go, you know what, I'm not ready to do that. And you can't, it's hard to stay still. You know, you're either moving forward or you're going backwards. So, I just sort of thought, no, I'm going to keep going as far as I can go. Until I stop enjoying what I'm doing, I'll keep trying to drive up. So I was MD reporting to a CEO of North America. And then when he left, I took on his role.
How long was that? How many years were you in that other role before he left?
About 18 months or so, two years.
Yeah, 2 years.
Working for him, there was part of me like, wow, do I need that? And it was, at a time when Interbrand was not doing well. They'd had a really amazing run, and then they'd, through a variety of sort of poor strategic choices, were in a really bad place. And there was a part of me was like, am I up for this? This isn't going to be a nightmare of a role for a period of time. But I just thought, well, why not? I mean, I felt an obligation because I thought I can actually fix this.
Right.
And there's a lot of really great people here, and they deserve someone to lead them and to figure out how to make this a success. And I had a lot of heart for Interbrand. It's an amazing company. It had just lost its way in 2016, 2017. And so, yeah, I took it on, and it was a nightmare. It was a really tough few years.
What do you think you did? So, I mean, and I know that, you know, there's a lot of things that you do around, you know, kind of creating a socially conscious company. I know mental health is also a topic that's, you know, very top of mind for you. Obviously, we talked about, you know, with your mother early on. Like, what are some of the things that you did that you feel like culturally helped to kind of make that shift? You know, are there a few things that really stand out to you around things that are just maybe important to you as a CEO, or things that you've learned that really can, you know, move the needle for a company culturally?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my dad's positivity and optimism.
Except for about your schooling.
Apart from that. But that's so that I think that is one of the most important roles of a leader is to set a tone of optimism and possibility and positivity and to believe in people. And that was what had been missing in the previous culture of Interbrand, was just they'd gone through a period where the leaders had not believed in them and not believed in what the company could do, and it had sort of just eroded from the inside. So, you know, we really worked hard to get people to believe in themselves, for the company to be seen to believe in them. And so that, to me, is really important. And we talked about this last time we spoke, but, you know, I grew up in Asia as a manager in an era where, you know, it was quite, I mean, almost paternalistic, you could say, right, but yeah. It was just the family of the company was really important. You know, how you treated people, you looked after them outside of their work, you know, especially in places like Indonesia and Bahrain, you had people, drivers or whatever it would be. And you know, people really cared about making sure they had what they needed, they were supported. If something happening in their family life, we were aware of it. So there was a real sense that that was an important part of being a leader and a manager. You really genuinely cared about the family of people that you looked after. And at the time, you know, it was the era of Jack Welch, and you know,
right,
and
yeah.
It was all about Jack. You know, ruthless, top down. You know, you go through everybody, and anybody who's in the top 50, bottom 15%, you fire them, and it's just brutal.
Gone.
You know? I was like the antithesis of that. So when I came back to Europe, I was like, oh my God, I'm not a leader equipped for this culture. But the world has moved on, you know, and the great thing is now we're in a place where, you know, millennials and Gen Z expect that same thing that Asians have been and folks in the Middle East and Africa have been expected from companies for forever. So I was fortunate in a way to earn my stripes in that, and that was what was needed to turn Interbrand New York around. In many ways, was just a much more caring, a much more considered, much more empowering, positive, optimistic vision for the business than had been there previously.
Are there a few turning points you remember? You know, over the last, and then you moved into the both the North American lead and global director of partnerships. So you've got the kind of global component now. Recently. Are there certain turning points you remember or certain things that really stand out for you as, you know, oh, okay, this thing's moving, you know, this thing's going in the right direction?
Yeah. I mean, I think, it's usually getting feedback from people who had been around through the bad old days and, you know, on a one-on-one or a little chat in the corridor saying, you know, wow, this place feels different, you know, and saying something positive about how, you know, whatever it was, like a town hall meeting that we had, like, you know, that felt really good. That's totally different. Like just little things that made signal that we're doing something right. And then, you know, get a great management team together. That's you know, always a critical thing for me. You surround yourself with great people. A very democratic leadership style. You know, we have now a team of 10 people in the leadership team. It's, you know, there's no hierarchy. It's not like I tell people what to do and they do it. We just come together and discuss and we agree on things and things happen. And you just feel that momentum shift, winning some businesses, you know, key bits of business that we had no right to win that we won. And then people go, okay, start to believe. And it just little things snowboard. So yeah, it's been a great journey. And you know, now the company is flying. We're doing really well. It's not just me. It's, you know, my boss is a global CEO. Has done an amazing job of turning it around. We're in a very different place. It feels really great to be at a company like that now, but it wasn't 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I think you tend to gravitate toward jobs like that, where it's like,
right.
You know, Coca-Cola's losing its business. You're like, I'm going to go fix it too. You know? So I think that, you know, it just shows that, you know, that I think there's certain people are wired to kind of run in to the hard thing, and maybe sometimes people aren't, or they just don't give themselves the opportunity to. And I think from walking through with the, you know, kind of the story with you over the last hour, it's I can say I think you like to run in. That's my hot take on it. And so as we kind of wrap up here, what's new and exciting for you? You know, maybe and maybe first thing, I'd love for you to tell just a little bit about what you all did during the pandemic around your internship program. I thought that was a really interesting story And then maybe we can kind of wrap up with just, you know, what's next, but maybe to share a little bit about that for, because I think the agency world in particular, a lot of people think is kind of this unapproachable or, you know, it's like a very specific culture type.
Yeah. I mean, Interbrand has prided itself on, its intern program over the last, you know, whatever decade or so, and amazing program they create. People come in for, you know, 4 to 8 weeks, whatever it is. And they, you know, work on a client project and they get it. It was an amazing opportunity to really learn what it takes to run a branding assignment. And what my observation was, it always had exactly the same people.
Right.
You know, as is the case in any internship program in a high profile company, you know, you just get sons and daughters of clients or people within Omnicom or, you know, Ivy League educated privileged people. And I said, we want to get a more diverse group. We've got to figure a way to do this. And we struggled. We just would get the same types of people every time. So we built a relationship with the Borough of Manhattan Community College, which happens to be right next door to our office in Lower Manhattan. And we went to see them and said, hey, listen, we'd love to put something together for your students, you know, kids from community college who've got a passion and interest in marketing and getting into our sort of world. So they worked with us. We got then 10 kids that came in, not all kids, because many of them were, you know, yeah, older people that were coming back to community college. And we brought them in for a sort of summer experience. And, you know, many of these kids had no experience of working and no idea what it would be like to work in a company like ours. They were all pretty quiet and shy. And often said, like, we've never done anything so public speaking. We're also terrified of that. And we, you know, we mentored them up with folks in the office. We put together a program. And these kids, oh my gosh, they blossomed in the 8 weeks they were with us. Just remarkable. I mean, and, you know, one way or another, each one of them at some point said, this has changed my life. You know, I'm not the same person that I was before I came to this. That, you know, they just to see a company that sort of looked after them, trained them, nurtured them. They, you know, went from being unable to speak in public to confidently presenting to the entire company. And it was, you know, everybody around us, you know, just loved it. I mean, I think most people at Interbrand will say that is probably the most precious experience they've had working in the company as being a part of that. And, you know, we're going to hire a couple of them where, you know, we'll keep in touch with them and we'll do it again next year. I mean, it was just such a phenomenal experience. And I think
that's,
it's
so awesome.
Really, really important to
do. And what are you excited about now? You know, as you look forward, what are some of the trends or things that have got you excited for the next year?
Yeah. I mean, for the company, I think I'm excited by, you know, we have permission to go into lots of different areas of business. We've been sort of very stuck in the branding world. I think we have permission to open up the aperture of what we're going to do. We're going to start offering some new products and services across the course of the next year or two, which I think is going to be super exciting. I'm really thrilled by that. And then from a personal perspective, I'm closing the loop because I've just bought 50 acres of land in upstate New York, which I'm going to turn into a farm. I am going back to my farming roots eventually.
I love it.
So that's really what's exciting me.
I love it. Yeah. I moved to Austin from New York 3 years ago and I'm like looking at ranch land, you know, kind of out a little bit as well too. So I can feel you. So that's exciting. I had a feeling that was going to happen. I had a feeling from earlier that there's this, because I knew that you had moved upstate or had some place upstate too. So Daniel, look, I really love this conversation. I think hopefully people have a lot of takeaways around, you know, being open to new opportunities, you know, finding those opportunities and taking, you know, letting kind of life guide you, but you also taking, you know, control over your own destiny. And I think your life and career is a testament to that. So I really appreciate, Daniel, you sharing that with everyone today.
No, thanks, Jake. It's been a real pleasure. It's nice to go down memory lane occasionally, so I've enjoyed it.
Good. That's awesome. All right. Well, thanks again, Daniel, and we'll see everyone next week on the Jake Dunlap Show.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in to another extremely fun and interesting episode. I thought it was fun and interesting, so I hope you did too, of the Jake Dunlap Show. Really great, just breaking down everything that makes people who they are, the success the trials and errors, and I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite platform, and make sure, more than anything, to go over to jakedunlap.com. That's where you're going to stay up to date on all the latest guests, additional details, prep notes. We're going to be sharing everything on jakedunlap.com. So go ahead, go over there. You can subscribe there as well, too. And we will see you next week on The Jake Dunlap Show.